Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with special guest appearances from my cat Chicken, probably. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm very excited to have writer, actor, comedian Joe Firestone here with me. Hi, Joe.
Hi, April.
Nice to see you.
I'm excited to be here.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
Nice to see you, too.
So for those of you who would like an introduction to Joe and her work, you're very lucky because I have one here and I love to read it to you. So please let me give this. Joe is a comedian, actress, and writer based in New York. Her first job came writing for the Chris Gephardt show before she jumped over to write for The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon and also the Adult Swim show Joe Parra Talks With You, where she also plays a character named Sarah Connor, a kind band teacher who becomes timidly involved with the title character Joe Parra. It is perhaps the gentlest show on television. Her work can be seen on Shrill, and her voice can be heard on Summer Camp Island. You can see her most recent special, Rate the Cookies, on Adult Swim as well, where she asks special guests to try cookies and either become friends or accept $50 in cash. Just a really difficult decision. So Joe is also the co-host of Dr. Game Show, a podcast on the Maximum Fun Network that you probably have heard of either in the promos for our show or other shows that you listen to. And I also was a guest on one episode that was so mind-boggling that I became a listener because I didn't know what was happening. So if you have not heard of that before, maybe just take a moment and check it out. So Joe, The movie that you chose to talk about today is just as boggling. It is Mars Attacks. And I was hoping that you could give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films.
Well, I love an ensemble cast. That's something I love an ensemble cast. I love it when people play multiple characters, which happens. And I think that the CGI is very, like, you want to squish their heads, which I really like a lot. And I like all the goo. And there's a lot of jokes in this movie, which I appreciate. And I think that it's also kind of like a rewarding thing where it's like if you followed Tim Burton for the last 10 years before this movie, you'd like see all the cast members. Like, you'd recognize all the cast members and you kind of get a sense of, like, who he likes to work with. But I think, yeah, I think that there's just some really, really solid goo and, you know, guns and jokes. And I'm all for it. I think had we not had Mars Attacks, we would not have Love Actually. I'll put that out there.
Okay, well, we'll get into that in the episode.
Okay.
So, for those of you who haven't seen Mars Attacks, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch Mars Attacks, this is your shot. It's on HBO right now. And now that you're back, let me introduce Mars Attacks with a quick synopsis that tries to get into everything, just to jog your memory. Okay, so written by Jonathan Gems, I think it's Gems, probably Gems. I think it's a soft G. With rewrites by Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski, and directed by Tim Burton for release in 1996, Mars Attacks stars a lot of people. First, we see a whole herd of cattle on a fire running down the street, and then a flying saucer goes back to Mars and returns to Earth with a whole fleet. The U.S. president, played by Jack Nicholson, watches at home as the military and all his advisors go out to the desert to meet the aliens and try to establish peace.
On behalf of the people of Earth, welcome.
So many people are there, including chat show host Natalie Lake and Hard News anchor Jason Stone. They roll out a translation machine that incorrectly translates the alien words to proclamations of peace.
We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
But the aliens are actually here for war, and they begin obliterating everyone, taking Natalie Lake for hostage, however, along with her little dog, which you figure out later on is for a fun experiment. The aliens storm Congress and zap everyone, and it's just the president and his close advisors left. The head science guy, Professor Donald Kessler, tries to plead with the alien ambassador.
Mr. Ambassador, what are you doing? This doesn't make sense. It's not logical. It's not...
but is also taken hostage. A hot lady alien infiltrates the president's office, but fails to kill him. Then the attacks ramp up all over the world, and eventually they get to the president.
Why can't we all just get along?
And take him out too. People are getting zapped left and right, but in Las Vegas, performer Byron Williams leads a group of desert survivors to an airfield where they encounter a group of aliens getting ready for battle. Byron, of course, challenges the ambassador to a fist fight.
Me, Byron Williams, heavyweight champion of the world!
And then gets overwhelmed by the horde, allowing the others to escape. Meanwhile, sweet guy Richie goes to rescue his senile grandma, but the two discover by chance that the aliens' heads explode when they hear Slim Whitman's song Indian Love Call.
When I'm calling you.
Richie, I think these guys are very sick. What's happening to them? What's killing them? I think it must be my music.
Richie and his grandma get the word out about the song, which is then broadcast all over the world. When the survivors emerge, the president's teen daughter, Taffy, is the only one left who can remotely be the leader of the free world. She gives a Medal of Honor to Richie.
On behalf of my parents, who couldn't be here today, for saving the world from the Martians, proudly presents you the Medal of Honor.
And against all odds, Byron comes home to his estranged wife and children, having survived his brawl with the aliens. And all is almost right with the world. Okay, so that's the end.
That was a great synopsis.
Thank you. It takes a long time. What do you fucking include? There's just a lot happening all the time.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. There's so many different... You really summed it up perfect. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is one of those things where Tim Burton essentially got a lot of money and said that he wanted to make an ensemble cast with pretty much any person that he ever wanted to work with. It's like, this is your shot. You know, like, I, you know, like, imagine you got just a dump truck of cash piled on you and you're like, you get to pick like 50 stars to do whatever you want. But he said, quote, I really wanted to try something different. The only time I had ventured into bringing together several high-profile stars was for the Batman movies, and here I wanted to repeat this experience, but even on a bigger scale. There are more than 20 lead roles in Mars Attacks, so it was quite a challenge for me to put together this cast. The first role I cast, however, was the one of Lisa Marie, my girlfriend, who is truly from another planet, and who could be the only human being to play a Martian. She's got such a fluidity and a remarkable sense of her body that she truly was mesmerizing and created a real eerie feeling, end quote. Which is funny because I'm like, he wanted a giant star-studded cast, but also his girlfriend.
She is real. I mean, she has no lines, but she's very, really great in that role.
She's so good. I mean, and we'll talk a little bit about that and just like having, you know, no lines and kind of using like body language to convey this like comic performance. But I think it's just, it's an interesting thing whenever I hear these interviews with Tim Burton. Like, he really does sound like a child, you know? He just wanted to put together, like, his favorite figures and just, like, you know, play like an army alien type of thing. Like, make his own Looney Tunes cartoon. If you could get, like, a buttload of cash, who would you make your top 20 stars?
I mean, the first person I'd cast would be Lisa Marie, probably, you know, just...
But also your girlfriend.
Yeah, also my girlfriend. I do. I mean, I think that it's like, I mean, Glenn Close truly was fantastic in this piece. Mm-hmm. Almost as good as, she's so good. I just saw her in another one, the one about the murder in the small town. And she plays the Christian woman.
Oh, God. Who, I don't know.
She's a choir director.
Hillbilly Elegy.
No, not Hillbilly Elegy.
The wife? I don't know.
But she's Cookie's Fortune. Yeah, she was like really good in Cookie's Fortune too.
It's shit,
like,
I forgot about that.
She's such a good character actor, and she like obviously is a star, so she can't play those very often. But she's so good. So I would put Glenn Close in there for sure. I'd put Bette Midler. I think I'd probably just mostly do women. Is the thing. I think I would just get all of the women that have ever played like character actors in the last 30 years, get them all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's a tough thing too, because if you've got lead actors who playing character actors, like that's fun. but sometimes they don't know, like there could be a character actor who's better at playing those parts. Yeah. I think about that in terms of just like, sometimes we want to have like the biggest name attached to things, obviously for budgetary reasons and for selling and overseas and that kind of thing. And then, but it turns out like there are people who like their careers are character acting, like they're, you know, like, and maybe they should be the ones who get those roles, but,
yeah. Well, I don't know. I also wonder if the way Tim Burton pitched it, I'm sure you know, but I wonder if he like, you know, like that story about the guy who was in Streetcar Named Desire and he played the doctor. And when someone asked him what the play was about, he was like, it's about a doctor that comes to visit a sick woman. And I wonder if Tim Burton had to frame each part as like, well, it's about a woman whose husband dies and then she has to go on a plane. Like, I wonder if everybody had that or if everybody knew.
Well, I think it's because there was so much writing and rewriting on the fly, especially when they had 50 main characters at one point in time. And then Tim Burton was just like, they were like, this is way too expensive. And so he was like, okay, I'll make it 20. I'll make it like 20 lead characters. But I think that it, the way it feels, at least, and from what I've read, it seems like each character gets their own kind of mini movie. And they may not be in the entire film and they may die very quickly, but they have their own kind of like short film that exists within the larger film of just like mm-hmm. their arc is set. And so I can see him potentially selling it. And also the fact that like he was kind of rewriting and writing in characters when people started getting cast, where it's just like, oh, like some characters existed because it was part of the main story and other ones they just wrote them in because they're like, oh shit, well, Sarah Jessica Parker wants to do it. So, I mean, like, let's give her something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Whoa, that's so interesting. I do think that it's so much easier to write when you know who's playing the person.
I mean, what's your best experience of doing something like that?
Well, I think that like it's just, I think like when we wrote season one of Joe Parra Talks With You and we kind of had an idea of who everybody would play, but obviously nobody had accepted the deals.
Yeah.
And, but then like once you got a sense of like how, like this guy, Gene Kelly, he plays the role of Gene Gibson in the, in the show. And it's kind of like just like figuring out how he talks in regular life is so helpful to writing, mm-hmm. Like going forward. Because otherwise, I mean, he can deliver any line. He's really funny and he's got a great voice and a great presence. But like, if you can figure out a way to make it natural, it's like so much. It feels, you can tell, you know, you can tell like on the screen.
It feels so beyond me, but I think if I could understand fashion, I could understand my sons. I saw a promo for a show called Fashion Police. Who sent them? They sit and criticize people's outfits. I wish they'd turn into a pile of leaves and get swept away by the wind.
Well, there's, I mean, in the show, there's kind of, I don't want to say a faux naturalness, but it's just kind of like exploitation of natural? Like, it's like natural exploitation and just like, it doesn't, like it's, it is natural, but it's very unnatural. So I would...
Yeah. No, yeah, like how no one would talk like that, but it's all people being natural talking like, I completely understand. Yeah. Yes,
although,
that's it.
You know, being from Michigan, I have to say it's fairly close in some ways. It's not unclose to how we speak.
Where are you from, Michigan?
I'm from Grand Rapids, so I'm from a very heavy accented side of the state. There's... You know, you were talking about writing characters who may or may not, the actors may or may not sign. And in this movie, obviously, it was very much of that. Everyone's just like, well, what are you doing? Are you going to do it? Are you going to do it? So it was just like deciding on who's going to go to the party. But Tim Burton said, quote, agents didn't want to see their star clients playing loser roles. And a lot of big acts pass on the project. At one point, we thought we were going to have to cancel the film. The guy who saved our butt was Jack Nicholson, end quote.
Whoa.
I get it. Like Jack Nicholson signs on and you're just like, oh, okay. Well, like this isn't just like some kind of like Space Jam type of thing because it really could have been Space Jam. I'm sure that with that many stars though, could you imagine if it just like dragged on and on? I feel like it would be, you know, like when like in the Avengers when they talk about like deciding who gets top billing on things because there's just like so many fucking lead actors that you're like, like, who's the star? Yeah. Who gets the special treatment? Who gets the special treatment on Joe Pera? Is it you? Or you? Who
no.
gets, like, the star treatment?
I think Joe Pera, yeah. But it makes sense because it's his show. He created it. But I think, and it's like, it kind of is like everybody's friends or everybody's worked together. Like, Gene and Connor used to work together at mm-hmm. Seth Meyers. Gene's the cameraman there. And, like, yeah, we've all kind of been working together for so long that it's, like, star treatment. I think that would be, like, a pretty big pull. Like, that would just, you'd have to really come back changed. Like, maybe, I don't, that would be a hard, it would be a hard one to pull. But I do think that, like, I don't think you could do it on that show, but, like, it does seem amazing. Like, I just heard this story about Shirley MacLaine, and she was, like, in this one thing where she's like, if you don't get this wig on me in 8 minutes, I'm going to start screaming. And then after 8 minutes, it wasn't on, and she did start screaming. And then the next time, it was always on in 8 minutes. Like, they had a bunch of hairdressers on to help her get it on in 8 minutes. And it's like, I don't know. I think there is something pretty amazing about stars like that act like that. I know it's like the worst possible situation to work with them, but I do think it is such a beautiful display of human power.
Yeah, you're just like, you automatically have the will to do these things because I've willed that you have to. There's no other alternative. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a lot more Mars Attacks and all of Joe Firestone's projects. We'll be right back. Hi, it's your host, April Wolf, and I'm here to talk to you about Storyblocks. It is something I think a lot of our listeners will be very interested in because it is dedicated to being the world's best royalty-free stock media subscription service with an ever-growing library of stock assets, including music, images, sound effects, and more. And they have affordable subscription plans and tools with the Storyblocks Unlimited All-Access plan, so you can get unlimited downloads of everything in the library. And even if your subscription ends, everything you've downloaded is yours to keep. So one of the things that I think is really cool about this is the fact that a lot of our listeners maybe have looked at stock libraries before and said, I don't see anyone that looks like me. Well, Storyblocks also launched their Restock, which is an initiative to increase diversity in their library. So it's committed to having 20% of their footage with people containing Black, Indigenous, and people of color by 2022, with plans to expand their scope to include more underrepresented groups in the future. So they've got some assets that you might be interested in. So you can explore their library and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/switchblade, and that's storyblocks.com/switchblade.
I'm Judge John Hodgman.
And I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne.
10 years ago, I came on Jordan Jesse Go and judged my first dispute. Is chili a soup? It's a stew, obviously.
The judge has dispensed a decade of justice. He's the one person wise enough to answer the really important questions. Like, should you hire a mime to perform at your own funeral?
After they cry, I want them to laugh.
Do you really need a tank full of jellyfish in your den?
They smell like living creatures decaying.
Only if they are decaying.
Yeah, which they will be.
Real people, real justice, real comedy.
Winner of the Webby Award for Best Comedy Podcast.
The Judge John Hodgman Podcast, every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Joe Firestone, and we're talking about Mars Attacks. So one of the things that was weird about this one was the fact that Tim Burton had no idea that Independence Day was being made at the same time.
Oh, no.
And then Independence Day, Roland Emmerich, when he brought this Independence Day out, and they were just like, they caught word that Mars Attacks was coming out and that it was going to be making fun of it, that type of movie, they moved their release date up to make sure that they could hit it, because they weren't sure that they were actually going to get it done by like 4th of July. And so they like moved the release date up and just kind of like sped things up. So they're like, we have to get this out before Mars Attacks. And so they did. And so I think they ended up kind of stealing some of the Mars Attacks box office.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Isn't it wild?
Wow.
Well, I mean, thinking about that in terms of like having to kind of compete with other things, whether that's in like selling a show, selling or, you know, writing a show that has something that's similar of it. Have you ever had that experience where you just like, you feel like you have to kind of like compete with someone else who's doing, who it feels like they might have a similar tone or a similar idea that you, you know, you have to kind of like beat people to the punch?
I think that other people have beat me to the punch. Just in terms of like, I've obviously never made a show, like a series or whatever, but yeah. A lot of times when I'll pitch something, they'll be like, oh, we just heard something like this. And I'll be like, oh yeah. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I guess I'll just go find them and ask them, how's it going? And But yeah, I think that it happens. I mean, I think it's also like a lot of people, like, I think that the ideas right now, like, for example, the ideas right now that are like getting greenlit, a lot of them are like sci-fi related.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like this thing where people like want to escape reality so badly.
Yeah.
And I think it is kind of like easy to think like, okay, like I got to get my idea out there. Because it's, but I think that there's a lot of similar ideas around the same time that like, I remember when I was like 25, everyone I knew was pitching something like Broad City.
Oh, really?
Because it was like, oh my gosh, like I'm living this crazy life and I'm in my 20s and I have, this is so funny. I have to make this a show. And then like a year later, they were like, no more pitches about single women living. Please, no. Yeah.
I mean, it's just sad if you like don't catch that zeitgeist in time. But yeah, it does sometimes feel like there's something in the air where everyone's kind of doing the same thing and you're not quite sure why the overlap exists, but it's like potentially filling a void that you didn't know that the culture had or something. We all get the same idea. Yeah. But in terms of things that will always be popular, that will never die and that are perennial favorites, there are certain things in Mars Attacks that I would say fit that bill. And one of those, as was discussed by Tim Burton quite often, again, is the sexy alien character that Lisa Marie plays. Because just in terms of like the archetype of like a sexy version, almost like the Bugs Bunny-ness type of thing, you know, like when Bugs Bunny goes in drag and he's just like gonna seduce someone to like like that character feels like an archetype that will never go away and it is like always kind of beloved in this strange sense. But that's, you know, what he was trying to do with Lisa Marie. He said, quote, I remember the cover and issue of a magazine illustrated by artist John Pound featuring a Martian lifting its disguise of a buxom blonde beehive-wearing vixen to reveal a bulging green brain and bloodshot eyes. This was very much in the spirit of the 60s kind of sci-fi movies that I was trying to recreate, and I remember always liking those movies where there was some sort of weird alien girl, end quote. And, you know, like, but there's also just, like, always one alien or well, one girl in general, the Smurfs. There's just like they throw in like one girl and like that's the kind of trope that continues on.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird.
Yeah, it is weird. It's not I think that kind of like, at least when I was growing up, that like whole thing, like it seemed like the ultimate job was to be a Hooters girl. I remember in elementary school just talking to people about like how great it would be to be a Hooters girl. Like that seems to be the ultimate life.
Like what did you think the perks were in elementary school?
I don't like they were oh, just that's... like every time I saw them in media, like I just like they seemed so happy and beloved, you know. And obviously I didn't really understand sex or sex appeal, but I was just like, They're having a good time and they like seem, you know, warm and, you know, like they're working. And yeah, I think I wonder if kids growing up now have like that same kind of, I'm sure that there's like that kind of sex symbol, but I do think it's mm-hmm. it seems like there's always been a Marilyn Monroe of like Jessica Rabbit style character for
again a Jessica Rabbit that, yeah there's like yeah, that, one very sexy female monster cartoon alien, Gremlins. I love the sexy lady in Gremlins, like she's just fantastic. And
yeah, the M&Ms, there's a sexy M&M. Yes,
exactly. Yeah.
It seems like that's and that's a round piece of chocolate. covered in candy. And somehow they made it hot.
Would you want to play one of those characters? Just like a,
An M&M?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, if you...
Yeah.
You could voice the sexy...
No, I don't think that that is... I don't think that that's in my wheelhouse, to be honest. I think that that's... I think that maybe... like, I remember in high school, there was this part, we were doing this play, and there was the seven deadly sins in the play.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing seven?
Yes, you're doing seven, the musical. Somebody played the head in the box. It was really cute. But it was like, I remember thinking I wanted Lust so bad. I wanted to play Lust. And I begged my drama teacher to play Lust. And she, like, wouldn't listen to me. And she gave me Glutton. I was so pissed. And I just, like, didn't. I remember thinking, if it's not going to happen when I'm 18 years old, I don't think it's going to happen for me. But that I've kind of embraced that. I think it's okay.
Glutton's a great one to be, you know?
Yeah, great. Better than, you know, anger or greed. Oh, yeah. I'd
or
say
sloth,
second
even.
Best. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, sloth's pretty fun, you know, if you think about it. But, yeah.
I wanted to get into something that I found really interesting in the interviews that I was reading from Tim Burton is the fact that he saw UFOs before. He said, quote, and this is for a couple of different reasons why I'm saying this, but he said, quote, "I have to admit, I've had two UFO encounters in my life and twice with Lisa Marie. Go figure. So I can only be one of those believers who thinks we are not alone in the universe. Now, when it comes to the abuse on the commercial level of revelations such as the one of NASA indicating the existence of simple life on Mars, I think this must be a cheap publicity stunt by the studio to promote my movie. I believe that the ongoing appeal of the invaders from outer space genre is not related to scientific discoveries. The only reason for making a film like Mars Attacks is actually something very basic. I just like monsters," end quote. There's a lot going on in this quote that, like, there's no follow-up answers in the interview, and I was just like, what? Like, you didn't want to like, he's accusing NASA of releasing information to promote the movie about simple life on Mars. Okay.
And just two UFO sightings.
If we're going to kind of sum up what this quote means to me, though, it seems like he really only does something because he's interested in it, because he likes it, which is like such a luxury in this mm-hmm. industry, especially when you're working at this budget level. You know, when he was early in his career, it'd be like, I enjoy this. I would like to make this $80 million movie. I've seen some aliens. I would love to make an alien movie. But I find that, again, a luxury that not many people are afforded, but he just seems so kind of like committed to having fun that people around him are like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, that's what I really loved about his work. And then I made the mistake of watching Sleepy Hollow recently.
Okay.
That was a big mistake. And yeah. I regret my time spent. And what happened? Why did he become so miserable? Because it did seem like there was so much fun in his earlier work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for someone who seems to be kind of putting his kind of personal thoughts and pleasures on the screen, like maybe he's going through a divorce. Like, yeah. I always wonder, just like there's like a pretty dark period, like were you just like going through something, you know, like Big Fish was obviously something for him where he was like going through something. And mm-hmm. that has a, you know, a kind of. I don't want to, like, a dour but fantastical feel to it that is, you know, outside of the kind of, like, hijinks, practical jokes of his earlier work. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just wonder if Sleepy Hollow was just, like, a divorce or someone died, you know?
Yeah, and then don't get me started on that, you know, Sweeney Todd. I don't know what happened to him, but I don't know. I think that maybe it seems like he didn't. I don't know. I don't know what it's like to have that much success and to have that much, many of your ideas put out there, that maybe it's just like you start to rely on your old ideas that work. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like when you're juggling maybe multiple projects, you're probably having to like look forward to the future. Do you ever feel like you're kind of falling back on things that you've used before?
I think that the problem that I encounter is that sometimes I'll find some idea so funny, and then I'll put it in everything that I'm working on. Mm-hmm. And then I'll like look back at what I've worked on and I'll be like, oh no, well, that joke's already been used twice in two different things. But I think that's kind of like a problem of the, maybe I just don't really know how to do show business, but it does seem like you have to be constantly working on 3.5 things at once at least. Yeah. And so like, I don't really know how to function like that, but I do think that it's, I don't know if I've started to like repeat stuff in stuff I've made, but I think sometimes it's easier to find inspiration than others, and sometimes it's when you have the least funding and least attention on you is when you have the most ideas.
That's when the UFO comes out of the sky. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more Mars Attacks and Joe Firestone's work. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Jesse. What you're about to hear is real.
Hey, this is Chris.
Hi, Chris. It's Jesse calling from Maximum Fun.
Hey, Jesse.
I heard that you got into a car accident.
Yeah, I was listening to Stop Podcasting Yourself, and I just laughed so hard that I slammed into a construction barrier.
Do you remember what it was that was so funny?
I will never forget, I'm sure. They started talking about Vegas and the, you know, if it happens here, it stays here, and that slogan. And then Graham was talking about, oh, you know, wasn't there some other slogan for another commercial?
Oh, it was like a commercial for food, and it said, like, whatever's in there stays in there. I can't remember what it was, clams or something.
Clams?
Just so ridiculous. And man, I got lightheaded. I was laughing so hard. Next thing I know, smash. So, yeah. They are just brilliantly funny.
So I talked to Dave and Graham from Stop Podcasting Yourself. We would like to pay your car repair bill. Is that okay?
That would be super nice, Jesse. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Joe Firestone, and we're talking about Mars Attacks. So something that I want to talk about is the idea of a punch-up writer or someone who rewrites projects but who doesn't get credit for them. I think it's interesting. Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski rewrote large portions of Mars Attacks, but they didn't take any screenwriting credit. Okay, so Larry said, quote, "They always hire us to bring a funky sensibility and edge. They do whatever they can to kid themselves into believing their crap is good," end quote. And I think that's, you know, it's a funny thing, but it's like, I'm sure that they probably, as a writing team, you know, having done like so many like iconic things like Problem Child, for instance, just like being like the weird kids, essentially, mm-hmm. that like they're like, oh, you're weird and edgy and we don't quite understand you, but like the kids love you. So like, let's bring you in to like punch up some jokes or like write some stuff that's relatable. And of course, they did that on this project too before it went back into the hands of Tim Burton and Jem. But I just find that something very interesting that so many people don't really ever think about is like how many hands have touched a script that no one knows.
It is weird, and it is so rarely like one person just writes a script.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever seen that before of anything I've ever done.
No, no. Well, I mean, especially like the studio level for sure. Like there's definitely some indies where you're just like, okay, well, they get to like kind of have their vision or whatever. But once you get to any kind of like funding level, it's like, no, there's going to be a lot of hands on every single thing.
Yeah, it is also like just having done punch up on a lot of scripts, it is kind of like you have to, it's a weird... It's a weird skill you have to access because you have to kind of like see, first of all, like what the voice of the writer is.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to kind of figure out the voice of all the characters too. And it's like this weird combination that you have to, because like you can make anything funny according to you, but you kind of have to make it funny according to them. And usually yeah. without talking to them, they usually yeah. they just send you the script and say, okay, make it better. And like, you know, in some level, you're going to insult them, you know, and it's like you're trying to help them, but it's going to hurt.
That's yeah, it's like, sorry, this is first aid that's also gonna like really yes. sting. The way that Scott and Larry talked about it is like that they're, you know, like their agents maybe don't like sell them necessarily as like the cool guys or something, but like that's kind of mm-hmm. like how they're known and how people approach their management, you know. Does your representation have like a, you know, like, well, you know, we've got kind of like a kooky, quirky type of a sensibility over here with Joe? Like,
I don't know. I don't think I ever want to know. But I think that, like, most of the time it's kind of just like friend stuff, or like friend stuff that's like really close to being made, and they just want to make sure it's like at the very best it can be. And like, so it does feel like kind of an honor to be able to do punch up on somebody's script, because it's a lot of trust and a lot of like responsibility to try to make it better. But at the same time, I think I think by the time you've gotten notes from 8 different network executives and done like, 25 drafts or whatever, you're probably like so fragile at that point. Like, you know, that you're just like, oh, would it? Yeah, I know it's not great. It's, you know, and then to kind of try to make someone feel good about their work, but also try to figure out a way to make the work shine through is kind of tricky.
Oh, yeah. You could just, I don't know, you could just rewrite it for them. Like, here you go.
Yeah.
Here's my but then thing.
It's also like, if they send you a, you know, a 50-page script and you have like 3 punch-ups and they paid you for it, they're like, what the hell? So you really do have to do some work on it, but, you know, not enough that, I don't know, it's kind of a balancing act.
I want to talk a little bit about the idea that in this movie, Tim Burton is actually trying to essentially mimic something from the past that felt cheap, that looked cheap, that was cheap, but making it without making it feel cheap, you know, because there's like all of those old movies, you know, like what he was talking about when he did Ed Wood too, is just like the fact that there's a cheapness to them, but you don't want to almost mock them by making it look cheap. There has to be like a kind of balance struck between them. He said, quote, you want to capture that feeling without being so cheap. So trying to do the spirit of those and upgrade it. When you're a kid watching those things, you don't feel like they're bad or cheap. We're just trying to capture that feeling, end quote. And I think about that in terms of also what you guys are doing with like Joe Pera, because it is kind of like a quiet, almost public access show, but not. And the idea of like having a production value without kind of overextending your reach and like what the visual style is, or you know, there has to be like a fine balance between those things.
Yeah, I think that that's like, I think that's a big thing, like when you're coming up and you like only have access to like certain cameras and you only have access to certain lights and you just only can make it as good as you can with the money that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And like trying to make the material, like it's kind of a bummer because like if you are only writing big, you know, big shiny floor ideas, like it's kind of difficult to execute it. And it kind of forces you to only create things that are affordable.
Yeah.
But I do think that that is kind of, and it's like doesn't really prepare you for if you do have money in a production. But I do think that that is something that like, it can inform your art in a way that's could be kind of fun. Like we just did this Rate the Cookie thing, and like we only had money for one light, and that like that was it. Like we tried to get 2 lights, and they're like, no, there's only one light. And then we were like, okay. And so we just had to like race before sundown, and it's like, of course, it's like cold, and it's getting sundown's happening faster than ever, and like this like kind of urgency and like. We had like 11 people that were contestants, and like the last three we were just like, what do we want from that, what do we, and it was like this kind of frantic like fighting against the sun element that I think, like, yes, it would have been better if we had more lights and if we could do this like in a controlled environment and we didn't like have a time crunch, but I do think that that kind of created a different tone to the interviews that I do think helped.
Yeah, it becomes like more and more desperate. Like,
yeah, like there's a vein that's like in my face that you didn't see before, just like a stress vein. But I think it does kind of like, I don't know, there is something about like using that as a writing tool and like a using that kind of the whatever you're afforded to help inform the piece.
But I mean, what would Jo Firestone do if she had like $80 million?
I think maybe probably a big musical for sure. Big musical. But
with
I think
two
that
lights.
Yeah, with two lights. But I do, I just love the idea of like a big like shiny floor production. But for right now, I haven't thought of anything like that because that's not something that I know how to make. And I wish that I could kind of go beyond that. But as of right now, I just think about what's in my wheelhouse, and what's in my wheelhouse is low budget. Like, where can I shoot things in a house or outside? And like that kind of thing is where my brain goes.
Yeah. Well, we hear it again and again, too, when I do these research on movies, where there's a lot of filmmakers who came from very kind of small thinking about their projects because they came from the indie world. And then when they get handed this budget, they become much more flexible and adaptable to how to make things work in a way where, like, sometimes even their crews don't understand, where their director is just like, no, like, you have to do it this way because we have no light. There is, like, you know, we have no location, so we do it like that. And then it's just like a very kind of frictious and contentious world for them kind of entering these larger budget projects sometimes.
It seems like such a you have to be such a big problem solver as a filmmaker. It seems like, I'm not a filmmaker, but I do think it's like, that seems to be the number one skill.
Yeah, making decisions, solving problems. Super fun. Why would anyone want to do this?
I remember I was acting in a sketch, and the director, we were shooting it outside at night, and there was like somebody talking in the park. And like, obviously we couldn't shoot because there was someone talking in the park. And the filmmaker had to stop what he was doing and go over and talk to the person talking. And I remember thinking, like, it's all about just like problem solving and confrontation and like trying to be a people person in like while making your art. And it's so many things to juggle. And like, it's such an admirable skill to develop that it's like, that's not something that's not something that comes naturally to me.
Before we go, I wanted to make sure that we cover the fact that, like, Tim Burton always has this reverence for older actors in casting them and people who have kind of a history in cinema and what they bring to a project. You know, when you're talking about, like, casting Gene earlier and just, like, thinking about certain actors who they might not be older, they just, like, have a kind of pedigree to them in some way. And he said, quote, "I love somebody that has had a life and you learn from them. It's nice to see from people you can learn from, see their history. And it's something I've had a few times. And I really enjoy it with certain people like Vincent Price. You learn something from these people on set," end quote. And I feel like that must be like just an extraordinary time if you're like getting to write for someone who's like a legend. And I'm sure like when you're doing Jimmy Fallon or anything too, that there's just like a kind of cavalcade of stars that have to come through sometimes and you just get to like witness them, you know?
Yeah. Or just like trying to pitch for certain celebrities that you've like looked up to your whole life and just kind of being like, what if they ate an apple and then just tripped on a stick. And then, like, sometimes they accept those pitches and you're like, oh, no, I can't believe I got to talk to these people and tell them this dumb idea. And then, yeah, that's kind of an amazing part of the whole late night thing. I remember one time it was like such a weird moment. I remember I was there and I was walking down the hall and all five of the Backstreet Boys, who are now in their 40s, maybe early 50s, were walking down the hall in chicken suits. And I was like, oh, this is This, they're taking people's ideas. And I used to, like, I truly used to worship them beyond anything that I should have, like gods. And then here they are walking in chicken suits down the hallway.
But because of who they are, who they've been, all of a sudden it elevates whatever sketch they're in, whatever they're doing, to something like surreal. Like there's an extra layer or depth behind it just because of like who they are or what they've done. As we close up, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Mars Attacks.
Oh, thank you for having me. I learned so much. This was really great.
I learned so much too. So again, people can watch Joe Parra Talks With You on Adult Swim. They can also see your new special on Adult Swim. Essentially, do you own Adult Swim? Do you
have shares? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Them, I mean, like, and Apple. I'm really trying to get my portfolio up and running.
Okay. All right. So watch Joe Parra Talks With You and also Rate the Cookies and listen to Dr. Game Show on Maximum Fun as well. Thank you so much for coming on, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group, too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
We come in peace. We come in peace.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.